One boy overbalanced with a suitable assist from one of his companions, and over he went, head first into the water. However, it was not very serious. He managed to drag himself ashore covered in a particularly gluey mud which already I, to my cost, had encountered in that river. Then all the boys rushed down the bank and helped him get clean because they knew what mother and father would say to each of them if they all went back into Lhasa City and left the boy in such a horrid state. More to the east the boatman was still plying his trade, ferrying across the river, making a great production of it in the hope of being able to drag a little more money out of his passengers. This was a thing that really interested me, because at that time I had never been on the water in a boat, and at that time it was really the height of my ambition. A little farther along the ferry road was another small park, the Kashilinga, along the road which led to the Chinese mission. I could actually see the Chinese mission walls from my room, and I could look down on the garden even though it was well shielded by trees. We boys always thought that horrible atrocities were taking place in the Chinese mission, and who knows? It may be that we were correct. More to the east was the Kartilinga, a very pleasant but somewhat damp park, located in swampy ground. Further away was the turquoise bridge which I could see, and the sight of which delighted me. I thoroughly enjoyed seeing people enter the covered enclosure, later to emerge at the other end. Beyond the turquoise bridge I could see the city of Lhasa, the council hall, and, of course, the golden roofs of the Jokang, the cathedral of Lhasa which was perhaps the oldest building in our country. Far beyond were the mountain ranges and the dotted hermitages, and the great heaps of different lamaseries. Yes, I was well satisfied with my room. And then it occurred to me that I could not see the Potala. Simultaneously the thought occurred to me that high officials of the Potala could not see me either, so if I dropped pebbles or lumps of tsampa onto unsuspecting pilgrims no one would see me, and the pilgrims would put it down to birds. In Tibet we did not have beds, we slept on the floor. Most times we did not have cushions or anything else on the floor. We just wrapped ourselves in blankets and lay down, perhaps using our robes as a pillow. But it was not time to retire, instead I sat with the window at my back so that the light streamed in over my shoulders, and I picked up a magazine. The title meant nothing to me because it might have been English, French, or German, I could not read any of them. But as I turned to this particular magazine it appeared to be an Indian one, because they had a sort of map on the cover and I could recognize some of the names, some of the shapes of the words. I turned over the pages. The words meant nothing to me, and I devoted myself exclusively to the pictures. As I sat there feeling content, feeling that my lot had changed for the better, I was quite happy to just look at pictures while my thoughts wandered far afield. Idly I turned the pages, and then I stopped and laughed and laughed and laughed to myself. Here in the two center pages were a collection of pictures of men standing on their heads tying themselves into knots and all sorts of things of that nature. Now I knew what I was seeing, some of the yoga exercises which were then very much the cult in India. I laughed hard and loud at some of the expressions, then stopped suddenly as I looked up and saw my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, smiling at me through the open communicating door. Before I could scramble to my feet he waved me down, saying, "No, we want no formality here, Lobsang. Formality is suitable for formal occasions. But this room is your home just as my room," he motioned through the open doorway, "is my home. But what was making you laugh so much?" I suppressed my rising mirth and pointed to the yoga pictures. My guide came into the room and sat on the floor with me. "You should not laugh at others' people's beliefs. You know Lobsang, because you would not like other people to laugh at your beliefs. These," he motioned to the pictures, "are practicing yoga. I do not do yoga, nor do any of the higher lamas do it. Only those who have no ability to do metaphysical things do yoga, master," I said in some excitement. "Will you tell me something about yoga, how people do it, what it is? I am very puzzled about the whole thing." My guide looked at his fingers for a few moments, and then answered me, saying, "Well, yes, you have to learn about these things. Let us talk about them now. I will tell you something about yoga. I sat and listened while my guide talked. He had been everywhere, and seen everything, and done everything, and I wanted nothing so much as to model myself upon him. I listened with more care than a small boy would normally give as he talked to me. I am not interested in yoga, he said, because yoga is merely a means of disciplining the body. If a person already has discipline of the body, then yoga becomes merely a waste of time. In this, our country, no one except the very much lower classes ever practices yoga. The Indians have made very much of a cult of yoga, and I regret that exceedingly because it is leading one away from the real truths. It is conceded that before one can do various metaphysical practices, one must have control of the body, must be able to control one's breathing, one's emotions, one's muscles. But he smiled as he looked at me. I am opposed to yoga because it is merely trying by brute force to do that which should be achieved by spiritual means. While he was talking, I was looking at the pictures, and it did seem remarkable that people should try to tie themselves up in knots and think it was being spiritual. But my guide continued, many of the lower types of Indians can do a form of trick by indulging in yoga. They are able to hypnotism and various other tricks which they have made themselves believe is a truly spiritual thing. Instead, it is a trick, and nothing more. I have never heard of any one going to the heavenly fields on the basis of being able to tie his body up in knots, he said with a laugh. But why do people do such remarkable things? I asked. There are certain things, certain physical manifestations which can be achieved by yoga, and there is no doubt that if one practices yoga it can perhaps develop a few muscles, but that does not help in developing spirituality. Many of the Indians put on exhibitions, and such men are called fake ears. They travel from village to village and town to town putting on yoga exhibitions, perhaps tying oneself up in knots, as you call it, or keeping one's arm above one's head for a long time, or doing other remarkable things. They put on a holy pose as if they are doing the most wonderful thing of all, and because they are a noisy minority who bask in publicity, people have reached the conclusion that yoga is an easy way to reach the great truths. This is completely wrong. Yoga merely assists one to develop or control or discipline the body, and it does not help one achieve spirituality. He laughed and said, you would hardly believe this, but when I was a very young man I tried yoga myself, and I found that I was spending so much time trying to do a few childish exercises that I had not sufficient time left to devote to spiritual progress. So, on the advice of a wise old man, I gave up yoga and got down to serious business. He looked at me and then stretched his arm in the direction of Lhasa. He swung it round to include the direction of the Potala, saying, in all our country you will not find the higher types of Lama doing yoga. They get down to the real thing, and he raised his eyebrows and stared at me as he said this, you will always find that the yogas make a lot of public commotion saying how wonderful they are, how important they are, and how they have the keys to salvation and spirituality. Yet the true adept of metaphysics does not talk about what he really can do. Unfortunately, in yoga it is a noisy minority which tries to sway public opinion. My advice to you, Lobsang, is this, never, never bother with yoga, for it is quite useless to you. You were born with certain powers, clairvoyance, telepathy, etc., and you have absolutely no need whatever to dabble with yoga, it could even be harmful. While he had been talking I had been turning the pages quite without thinking, and as I looked down I peered because I saw what seemed to be a Western man wearing a contorted expression as he was trying to do an exercise. I pointed it out to my guide, who looked at it and said, ah, yes, this is a victim of yoga. A Western man who tried an exercise and dislocated a bone in the process. It is very, very unwise for Westerners to try yoga because their muscles and bones are not supple enough. One should only do yoga, if one really wants to, if one is trained from a very early age. For middle-aged people to do it, well, it is foolish and definitely harmful. It is ridiculous, though, to say that the practice of yoga causes illness. It does not. All it does is to bring in to use a few muscles, and at times a person may get a dislocation or a strained muscle, but that is the person's own fault, they should not meddle with such things. He laughed as he folded the paper and said, "The only yogi I have met have been real cranks. They have thought that they were the cleverest people ever, they thought that they knew everything, and they thought that the practice of yoga was the salvation of the world. Instead, it is just an exercise such as when you boys climb a tree or on stilts, and when you run so that a kite may be lofted into the air. Yoga? Just a physical exercise, nothing more, nothing spiritual. Possibly it can help one by improving one's physical condition so that then one is able to forget about yoga and get on with the things that matter, the things of the spirit. After all, in a few years everyone leaves a body, and it does not matter then if the body is full of hard muscle and strong bone, the only thing that matters then is the state of the spirit." He returned to the subject saying, "Oh, and I should warn you of this. Many practitioners of yoga forget that theirs is just a physical training cult. Instead, they have taken some of our occult healing practices and said that these healing practices are an adjunct of yoga. Such is completely false. Any of the healing arts can be done by a person entirely ignorant of yoga, and often done far better." So he pointed at me sternly, "Don't you ever fall victim to yoga publicity, it can actually lead you away from the path." He turned and walked into his room, then he turned back to me saying, "Oh, I have some charts here which I want you to fix on your wall. You'd better come and get them." Then he came over to me and lifted me up so that I should not have the struggle of getting up myself. I walked behind him into his room and there on a table were three rolled papers. He held one up saying, "This is a very old Chinese picture which many hundreds of years ago was made in veneered wood. It is at present in the city of Peking, but in this representation I want you to study carefully how the organs of the body are imitated by monks doing various tasks." He stopped and pointed to one particular thing. "Here," he said, "monks are busy mixing food and fluid, that is the stomach. The monks are preparing all this food to pass through various pipes before it reaches other monks. If you study this, you will get a very good idea of the basic workings of the human body." He rolled up the scroll again, carefully tied it with the little tapes which were already affixed to it, then he took another and held it up for me to see. "Here," he continued, "is a representation of the spine with various chakrams. You will see from this how the different centers of power are located between the base of the spine and the top of the head. This chart must be right in front of you, so that you see it last thing at night and first thing in the morning." Carefully he rolled up the scroll and tied that, then he went on to the next one, the third. He untied the fastening and held the chart at arm's length. "Here is a representation of the nervous system showing you things which you will have to study, such as the cervical ganglion, the vagus nerve, the cardiac plexus, solar plexus, and pelvic plexus. All these things you have to know because they are quite essential to you as a medical lama in training." I looked at the things feeling more and more despondent, because it seemed to me that I should never master all these things, all the bits and squiggles of the human body, all the wriggly bits that were nerves, and the great blobs that were chakrams. But, I thought, I've got plenty of time, let me just go at my own speed, and if I cannot learn as much as they think I should, well, one cannot do more than one's best. Now I suggest you go out and get some air. Just put these in your room, and then whatever you do for the rest of the day is your own affair. Unless you get up to mischief," he said with a smile. I bowed respectfully to him and picked up the three scrolls. Then I returned to my own room, shutting the communicating door between us. For a time I stood in the center of the room wondering how I should fix these wretched things, and then I observed that there were already suitable projections in the wall. Carefully I took a table and placed it beneath one of the projections, climbing the table, which gave me another foot or 18 inches of height. I managed at last to get the cord of the first chart over the projection. Carefully I retreated to the far side of the room and looked approvingly at my handiwork. No, it was not straight. I eyed the thing critically and hurried forward to make sure that everything was correct as it should be. Satisfied that one was hanging true and level, I went to work on the other two. At last I was satisfied, and I dusted my hands together with an air of complacency. Smiling with self-satisfaction, I walked out of my room wondering which way to go, but as I went out passing my guide's door, I saw the serving monk at the end of the corridor. He greeted me in friendly fashion, and said, "That's the quickest way out. It is a private door for lamas, but I have been told that you are permitted to use it." He motioned to it, and I thanked him and soon slipped out into the fresh air. I stood outside in the open. The end of the mountain path lay just beneath my feet. Over to the right, a crowd of monks were busy working. It looked to me as if they were leaning up the road, but I did not hang about. I did not want to be sent on any tasks. Instead, I moved directly forward and sat on a boulder for a time while I looked out over the city not so far away, near enough for me to distinguish in the clear, clear air of Tibet the dress of the traders, the monks, and the lamas who were going about their business. Soon I moved a few yards down and sat on another rock beside which there was a pleasant small bush. My attention now wandered to the swamp below me, the swamp where the grass was lush and green, and where I could distinguish bubbles as fish lurked in the deeper pools. As I sat there was a sudden rushing behind me and a hoarse throaty voice said, "Roar!" With that there was a hearty boink in the small of my back as a solid furry head greeted me. I reached round and stroked the old cat, and he licked me with a tongue which was as rough as the gravel on the ground. Then he rushed round to the front, jumped on my lap, jumped off, and made off through some bushes stopping just in sight, wheeling around to face me. He looked the very picture of inquiry as he stood there, tail straight up, ears straight up, facing towards me with his blue eyes glinting. I made no move, so he rushed up the hill again towards me saying, "Roar! Roar!" As I still made no move, he reached out with one of his paws and hooked his claws into the bottom of my robe and gently tugged. "Oh, cat, whatever is the matter with you?" I asked in exasperation. Slowly I scrambled to my feet and looked about me to see what the cat was agitating about. There was nothing to be seen, but the cat was rushing towards a bush in the distance and then rushing back to me and clawing at my robe. So I faced down the mountainside and began a slow, cautious descent, the cat fairly dancing with excitement, whirling around, springing into the air, and charging at me. I clung to the bushes as I made my slow way, and I reached the point where the cat had turned to face me, but there was nothing to be seen. "Cat, you are an idiot," I said in irritation. "You have dragged me down here just to play." "Roar! Roar!" said the cat, clawing at my robe again and weaving about between my legs, poking beneath my robe and nibbling at my bare toes showing through my sandals. With a sigh of resignation I progressed a bit farther, pushed my way through a bush, and clung on grimly because here was a legend. Had I not been clinging on so grimly I could have fallen over the edge. I turned to say some very unkind things to friend Gat, who was now in a frenzy of excitement. Darting around me he sprang over the edge. My heart nearly stopped with the shock, for the old cat was a very good friend of mine and I thought he had committed suicide. Very cautiously I sank to my knees and clinging hold of the bushes peered over the edge. About 12 feet below I saw the body of an aged monk. My horrified eyes saw that his head was blood-stained, and that his robe also had blood on it. His right leg, I perceived, was bent at an unnatural angle. My heart was palpitating with fright, excitement, and effort. I looked about me, and I found that just off to the left there was a small declivity down which I descended, finding myself then at the head of the old monk. Gingerly, nearly ready to jump out of my skin with fright, I touched him. He was alive. As I touched him his eyes flickered feebly and he groaned. I saw that he had fallen over and struck his head on a rock. The cat was now sitting, watching me carefully. Gently I stroked the old monk's head, stroking beneath the ears down the neck towards the heart. After some time his eyes opened and he looked vacantly about him. Slowly his eyes came into focus, focusing on me. "It is all right," I said soothingly. "I will go up and get help for you. I shall not be very long." The poor old man tried to smile, and closed his eyes again. I turned, and on hands and knees, as being the safest and the speediest, I made my way up to the top and rushed across the path into the concealed door of the lamas. As I entered, I nearly collided with the serving monk who was there. "Quick! Quick!" I said. "There is a monk injured on the rocks." As I was speaking, my guide came out of his room and looked inquiringly at the commotion. "Master! Master!" I said, "I have just found, with the aid of Honorable Puss Puss, an old monk who is injured. He has a head injury and his leg is unnaturally bent. He needs help urgently." My guide speedily gave instructions to the serving monk and then turned to me. "Lead on, Lobsang, I will follow," said he. Together we went out of Chakpora and crossed the small path. I led him down the steep path, noting with consternation that his saffron robe was getting soiled. My own was so soiled that a few more marks made no difference. Honorable Puss Puss was there dancing about on the path ahead of us, and he really looked relieved to see the Lama Minyard on up with me. Soon we reached the old monk who still had his eyes shut. My guide knelt down beside him and took various packages from the inner band of his robe, bandages and some stuff which he held on a piece of cloth and held beneath the old monk's nose. The monk sneezed violently and opened his eyes, eyes which were strained and pain-racked. He looked a very relieved monk indeed when he saw who was attending to him. "It is all right, friend, help is coming for you," said my guide. With that the old monk closed his eyes again and sighed with relief. My guide raised the monk's robe and we saw bits of bone sticking through the skin of the leg just beneath the knee. My guide said, "Hold his hands, Lobsang, hold him tightly. Rest your weight so that he cannot move. I am going to pull the leg straight." With that he caught hold of the monk's ankle, and with a very swift sudden pull, straightened the limb and I saw the bones disappear inside the skin. It was so sudden, so carefully done, that the old man did not even have time to groan. Quickly my guide reached out to two branches which were very convenient to hand on a fairly big bush. With a knife he cut them off, and padding them with a piece of his own rope he bound them as a splint on the monk's leg. Then we just sat back to wait. Soon there came shufflings and scufflings as a party of monks led by a lama appeared coming down the path. We called to them and directed them to the place where we were. Carefully they grouped about the old monk. One young monk, not at all carefully, tried to show off, tried to show how sure-footed he was. His foot slipped on the loose stones, his feet slipped from under him and he started to slide down the mountainside. A shrub caught the bottom of his robe and pulled it up above his head. And there he was, like a peeled banana, swinging naked to the gaze of pilgrims on the ring road below. My guide chuckled, and gave orders for two others to rescue him without delay. When he was pulled back he was looking very shamefaced and very red-faced, too. I noticed that he would have to stand for a few days if he wanted to be comfortable because that place in contact with the floor when sitting was quite badly scratched by the stones. Cautiously the monks turned the injured man so that they could slide beneath him a length of strong canvas. Then they turned him back and pulled so that he was upon a convenient stretcher. They tucked the cloth right around him, forming a tube of it, and then they slid a stout pole inside, binding him to the pole by broad lengths of webbing. He was unconscious, fortunately, and then two monks raised the ends of the pole and with others behind helping by pushing and steadying their footsteps they made their slow, cautious way through the bushes, up the mountain path, and into the safety of Chakpora. I stood patting Honorable Puss Puss, telling my guide the Lama Minyard on up how Honorable Puss Puss had fetched me down to come to the aid of the old man. "The poor old fellow would probably have died if you had not called, Honorable Puss Puss," said my guide, ruffling the old cat's fur. Then he turned to me saying, "Good work, Lobsang, you have started well. Keep it up." Together we scrambled up the mountain path, both of us envying Honorable Puss Puss who danced and gambolled ahead. My guide entered Chakpora, but I stayed sitting on the boulder at the top, teasing Honorable Puss Puss with a piece of bark, a nice flexible piece of bark which he pretended was some fierce enemy. He leapt, and growled, and roared, and attacked the bark, and together we had the strongest sense of warm friendship. Chapter 13. It was good to be back at Chakpori, good to be among those with whom I was familiar. Here the teachers were a dedicated lot, dedicated to training medical lamas. My guide had suggested that I should attend classes for herbs, anatomy, and medicine, as Chakpori was the center for such teaching. With 25 others, boys like me, older boys, and one or two young monks from other lamasaries, I sat upon the floor of one of our lecture halls. The lama teacher was interested in his work, interested in teaching us. Water. He said. Water is the key to good health. People do not drink enough to make the body function correctly. One eats, and there is a stodgy mess inside one that cannot traverse the lengthy path through the intestines. The result is a clogged system, bad digestion, an utter inability to undertake the study and practice of metaphysics. He stopped and looked about him as if to challenge us to think otherwise. Master, said a young monk from some lesser lamasery, surely if we drink when we eat we dilute our gastric juices, or so I have been told. The young monk shut up abruptly and glanced about him as if confused by audacity. A good question, said the lama teacher. Many people have that impression. But it is wrong. The body has the ability to put out a highly concentrated digestive juice. So concentrated, in fact, that under certain conditions the digestive juices can start to digest the body. We gasped in amazement, and I felt considerable fright at the thought that I was eating myself. The teacher smiled as he saw the commotion he had caused. For a few moments more he kept silent, that the full impact should dawn upon us. Gastric ulcers, stomach irritations, how are they caused? He asked, gazing from one to another of us in the hope of getting a reply. Master, was my brash response. When a man worries he gets ulcers in much the same way as he might get headache. The teacher smiled at me and replied, good attempt. Yes, a man worries, the gastric juices in his stomach become more and more concentrated, until at last the weakest part of the stomach is attacked, and as the acids which normally digest food erode away the weakest part and eventually make a hole, twinges of pain churn the stomach contents and lead to further concentration of the juices. At last the acids seep through the hole they have made and permeate between the layers of the stomach, causing what we know as gastric ulcers. An adequate supply of water would greatly alleviate the position and could even prevent ulcers. Moral: when you are worried, drink water and reduce the risk of getting ulcers. Master, said a foolish boy. I hope people do not heed this too much. I am one of those who have to carry water up the mountainside, and the work is hard enough now. Most people give no thought to the problems of a country such as Tibet. We had plenty of water, most of it in the wrong place. To supply the needs of lamasaries such as the Potala and Chakpori, teams of worker monks and boys carried leather containers of water up the mountain paths. Laden horses and yaks also were used to transport the water necessary for our being. Endless teams of workers toiled to keep filled tanks which were placed in accessible positions. We did not just turn on a tap and find a plentiful supply. Hot and cold, ours had to be dipped out of a tank. Very fine riverbed sand, also hauled up, was used for cleaning utensils and for scouring floors. Water was precious. Our laundry was the river's edge. We took our clothes to the river instead of carrying the river up the mountain. The lama teacher ignored the idiotic remark, and continued, the worst ailment of mankind, as he paused for dramatic effect, while we thought of plagues and cancers, constipation. Constipation causes more general ill health than any other complaint. It lays the foundation for more serious illnesses. Makes one sluggish, bad-tempered, and miserably ill. Constipation can be cured. Once again he paused and looked about him. Not by massive doses of cascara sagrada, not by gallons of castor oil, but by drinking enough water. Consider, we eat. We take in food, and that has to progress through our stomach and through our intestines. In the latter, short hairs called vi, they are like hollow tubes, suck up nutriment from the digesting and digested food. If the food is too stodgy, too solid, it cannot enter the vi. It becomes impacted into hard lumps. The intestines should wriggle as we may describe the action of peristalsis. This pushes the food along the alimentary canal, making room for more. But if the food is solid, peristalsis merely results in pain and no movement.